I looked around for a subject. I'd initially thought about something to do with the Exodus, maybe. But it's still just right around 7 weeks to the Days of Unleavened Bread, so I thought that this was maybe a little premature to tackle that subject. And so I'm going to cover something that we've covered in class this week. My apologies to the Foundation Institute students who are here. They will hear it twice, maybe slightly reformatted, a little bit different. But I opted for a different subject because it's caught my attention. I hope it'll be of interest to everybody. It's the history of one nation. The history, the prophecy, and lessons. History of one particular nation that's mentioned a little bit peripherally in the Bible. And I think that this particular history carries a lot of lessons for all of us as Church of God members. So let's begin by turning in our Bibles to Genesis chapter 25. Genesis chapter 25. While you're turning there, I'm going to get a little bit more water. Genesis chapter 25. And we're going to pick it up with a story that I think we're probably quite familiar with, but perhaps we don't always look at all of the prophetic implications. The story of Isaac, Genesis 25, beginning in verse 19. Here is the genealogy of Isaac, Abraham's son. Abraham begot Isaac, and then this interesting story about Isaac being 40 years old when he took Rebekah as wife, the daughter of Bethuel the Syrian. Verse 21, Isaac pleaded to the Lord for his wife because she was barren, and the Eternal granted his plea, and Rebekah, his wife, conceived. And here's where it gets interesting. I normally ask when we cover this at FI how many of the students are twins. I won't ask for a show of hands here, but maybe some in the congregation are twins. At least we've all seen twins in our families or communities. Two of them. The children struggled. Interesting, there's a plural introduced there in verse 22. The children struggled together within her, and she says, literally in the Hebrew, if well, why so? It's a very brief question that she asks in the Hebrew. She's asking this question because she knows that the conception is a gift of God, and yet she's feeling something in her womb, and what she feels doesn't feel good. So she went to inquire of the Eternal, and the Eternal said to her, two nations are in your womb, two people shall be separated from your body, one people shall be stronger than the other, and the older shall serve the younger. They've not been named yet, but it's already prophesied right from the beginning that the older would serve the younger. This was God's purpose. When her days were fulfilled for her to give birth, verse 24, indeed there were twins in her womb, and the first one came out red. Isn't that an interesting thought? The word for red is rather like the word Edom, which we'll read about later on. Rather like the word Adam. People ask sometimes what color was Adam. Well, he wasn't any of the color of any of the major racial groups that we have on the scene today. He was sort of a ruddy color. Anyway, he comes out red. And this wonderful description of the baby here, he was like a hairy garment all over. So they called his name Esau, which means hairy. You know, the writer Moses writing the book of Genesis didn't soften what he had to say here. The baby comes out all hairy. Afterward, his brother came out, and his hand took hold of Esau's heel, and his name was called Jacob, heel grasper, supplanter. Isaac was 60 years old when she bore them. So there was a 59-year lag, presumably, from the time that Isaac married Rebekah until the time that she gives birth to twins. And we've got the seeds of some problems in the family right at the beginning. Obviously not identical twins. Verse 27, the boys grew. Esau was a skillful hunter, a man of the field, but Jacob was a mild man dwelling in tents. Look how different they are in personality. Isaac loved Esau because he ate of his game, and Rebekah loved Jacob. We've got all kinds of problems immediately. Now, we've got the prophecy that the older is going to serve the younger, but we've got problems in the family with one parent aligning himself with one of the boys and the other parent aligning herself with the other one of the boys. A lesson here, obviously. Good parents know that they don't let their kids cause them to play favorites. We've got a problem then in the family, beginning in verse 29. And as we go through this, I'd like for us to look at these two chapters that give us the history of Esau and look at it from an evaluative point of view. Was Esau in the right or was Esau in the wrong? The first story here, the remainder of Genesis 25, is Esau selling his birthright. Verse 29, now Jacob cooked a stew, and Esau came in from the field, and he was weary. And Esau said to Jacob, please feed me with some of that, and the Hebrew reads something like this, please feed me some of that red red. The word for red is reduplicated in the Hebrew. One commentator makes the point here in verse 30 that Esau uses some rather vulgar language. When he uses the word feed, it's a unique word in the Old Testament, not usually applied to human beings. It's usually applied to animals, scarfing down some food. So what Esau says is something like this, let me scarf down some of that there red stuff. It's deliberately vulgar language. So his name was called Edom, red. Jacob said, sell me your birthright this day. Esau said, look, I'm about to die. What use is this birthright to me? Jacob said, swear to me as of this day. And he swore to him and sold his birthright to Jacob. That was, of course, a very important thing to have, the birthright. It made you the leader of the next generation. He sold his birthright. Jacob gave Esau bread and stew of lentils, and he ate and drank. No doubt he scarfed it down very quickly, arose, and he went on his way. Thus Esau despised his birthright. Now, I know we've read this before, but the question that I'd like for us to think about as we look at this history of Esau is, who's the good guy? Who's the good guy, and who's the bad guy? Obviously, Esau undervalued something that was of very great value. That birthright was very, very important. And the New Testament draws out for us the fact that we're given something of very great value, and we're not to make the same mistake that Esau made. We've been given the role of the first fruits of God's plan. We've been given the role of inheriting the pearl of great price. We know that eternal life lies ahead. And the lesson here for us is, when you're given something of very great value as a gift of God, you don't let it go. Let's keep our place in Genesis and turn to Hebrews chapter 12. Hebrews chapter 12. Hebrews has some comments on these events. Hebrews chapter 12. Hebrews 12, and beginning in verse 16. Let's just read verse 16 here. It says, lest there be any fornicator or profane person like Esau, who for one morsel of food sold his birthright. Now that, of course, is written to the church. And the lesson here for us is, don't go down that road. You don't sell your birthright. You don't sell your place in God's kingdom for a morsel of food, or for anything for that matter. So Esau forfeited his birthright. Who was in the right here? Who was wrong? Well, we read that and we say Esau was weak-willed. He lacked the character. But it gets to be a little bit more complicated when we move two chapters forward to Genesis chapter 27. The loss of the blessing. And the situation here, as we know, we've read it, I'm sure, is of old Isaac, the patriarch, whose life is about to end, and he's almost blind. It's interesting in the book of Genesis, there's a lot of press for Abraham, there's a lot of press for Jacob, there's not much for Isaac. This Isaac story comes and goes rather quickly, but this is interesting. Isaac is old and almost blind, and his wife, Rebekah, significantly younger than him apparently, sprightly, and seems a little bit manipulative. She certainly knows how to work the angles in all of this. As we evaluate Genesis 27 in terms of who's right and who's wrong, things are going to get to be a little bit more complicated. So let's read some of Genesis 27. I want to go through it. Came to pass when Isaac was old and his eyes were so dim that he could not see, he called Esau his older son, and he said to him, my son. And he answered him, here I am. In Hebrew, it's hineni. Esau raises his hand. Here I am, dad. What do you want from me? And he said, "Behold, now I'm old. I don't know the day of my death." He knows he's approaching. "Now, therefore, please take your weapons, your quiver, and your bow. Go out to the field and hunt game for me, and make me savory food such as I love, and bring it to me that I may die, that I may eat, that my soul may bless you before I die." Remember, Esau is Isaac's favorite, and Jacob is Rebekah's favorite. The role of Jacob and the role of Rebekah will be, as they say, interesting. Verse 5, Rebekah was listening when Isaac spoke to Esau, his son. She's eavesdropping without him knowing. Esau went to the field to hunt game and to bring it. Rebekah spoke to Jacob, her son, saying, "Indeed, I heard your father speak to Esau, your brother, saying, 'Bring me game, make savory food for me, that I may eat it and bless you in the presence of the Lord before my death. Now, therefore, my son, obey my voice according to what I command you. Go to the flock, bring me two choice kids of the goats, and I will make savory food from them for your father, such as she loves, such as he loves." She knows the recipe. "Then you shall take it to your father that he may eat it and that he may bless you before his death." It's a pretty elaborate deception that's about to take place. Jacob initially has reservations about it. Is this going to work? Jacob said to Rebekah, his mother, "Look, Esau, my brother, is a hairy man, and I'm smooth-skinned. Perhaps my father will feel me, and I shall seem to be a deceiver to him, and I shall bring a curse on myself and not a blessing." Verse 13, his mother said to him, "Let your curse be on me, my son. Only obey my voice and go get them for me." Interesting here, I'll just stop briefly in verse 13. Rebekah says, "Let your curse be upon me." And after this incident, there's no mention of Rebekah in the Bible, except for it just there's a passing mention about her burial place. What happened to her? We don't know. Verse 14, he went and got them and brought them to his mother. His mother made savory food such as his father loved. Rebekah took the choice clothes of her elder son Esau, which were with her in the house, and put them on Jacob, her younger son. And she put the skins of the kids of the goats on his hands and on the smooth part of his neck. I understand there was a sermon about conspiracy theories last Sabbath. I'm no believer in conspiracy theories. They usually don't have substance to them, but this sure was a conspiracy. She put the skins of the kids of the goats on his hands and on the smooth part of his neck, and she gave the savory food and the bread which she prepared into the hand of her son Jacob. This is pretty elaborate, you know, the neck, the hands. She knows where her husband is going to caress and hug Jacob. And he went to his father and he said, "My father," and he said, "Here I am. Who are you, my son?" Now look at the deception taking place here. Jacob said to his father, "I am Esau, your firstborn, lie number one. I've done just as you told me, lie number two. Please arise, sit and eat of my game that your soul may bless me. How did you find it so quickly, my son?" And maybe this is the pinnacle of chutzpah in verse 20. "Because the Eternal, your God, brought it to me." How's that for audacity? The Yiddish word is chutzpah. If you know that word, it's audacity. He's giving a lie. Not only is he giving a lie, but he's also giving out a lie and invoking the name of God in the context of the lie. Isaac said to Jacob, "Come near that I may feel you, my son, whether you're really my son Esau or not." Jacob went near to Isaac, his father, and he felt him. The voice is Jacob's voice, but the hands are the hands of Esau. Isaac still had enough perception, auditory perception, and he did not recognize him because his hands were hairy like his brother Esau's hands. And he blessed him. "Are you really my son Esau?" He said, "I am." What's that? Lie number four. "Bring it near me and I will eat of my son's game so that my soul may bless you." He brought it near him and he ate, and he brought him wine and he drank. And then he says, "Come and kiss me, my son." And there is the blessing, verses 27, 28, and 29. "Surely the smell of my son is like the smell of a field which the Eternal has blessed. Therefore may God give you of the dew of heaven, of the fatness of the earth, and plenty of grain and wine. Let people serve you and nations bow down to you. Be master over your brethren, and let your mother's sons bow down to you. Cursed be everyone who curses you, and blessed be those who bless you." And Isaac's blessing carried power. The blessing has gone out of his mouth. on the basis of some lies, on the basis of fraud, on the basis of deception. And right after this has taken place, in comes Esau, very upset, very angry, no doubt, because he's been defrauded. Now, you know the story. You've read it before. We've all read it before. But let's stop and ask ourselves for a moment, who's in the right? Who's in the right here? Probably many of us in this room are descended from Jacob. And when we read this account, you know, I don't know about you, but I don't feel terribly proud of what's going on here. This is our forefather. And it had already been said prophetically that the older would serve the younger. So had deception and lies and fraud not taken place, presumably it would have happened anyway. But deception took place and lies and fraud. And we ask ourselves, who's right and who's wrong? Esau was defrauded. And dropping down, then of course Esau comes in. And verse 32, his father Isaac said to him, "Who are you?" And he said, "I'm your son, your firstborn Esau." Esau's telling the truth. Isaac trembled exceedingly and said, "Who? Where is the one who hunted game and brought it to me? I ate all of it before you came, and I've blessed him. And indeed he shall be blessed." Isaac understands the power behind those prophetic words. When Esau heard the words of his father, he cried with an exceedingly great and bitter cry and said to his father, "Bless me also, O my father." I'm not going to read the remainder of the chapter. There's much more in this chapter. But it's interesting, in verse 34, this is actually the very first use of the word bitter in the Bible. Esau cries with a bitter cry. Esau, as a result of having been mistreated, having been done wrong, and having been defrauded, that word bitter shows up, and it becomes part of the character of Esau. Who's right? Who's wrong? I'm not taking the side of anybody in this. It's a little bit like the politics, national politics in this world, you know. We should be hard-pressed to take the side of one side against another. They all have their problems. Let's jump forward to verse 41. Genesis 37, verse 41. There's an interesting blessing there toward the end of Genesis 27, which I won't take the time to read, verses 39 and 40. But let's quickly look at this, verse 41. Esau hated Jacob because of the blessing with which his father blessed him. And Esau said in his heart, "The days of mourning for my father are at hand, and I will kill my brother Jacob." He, of course, did not do that. There was a sequence of events that took place. But Esau has this hatred. He has this bitterness. It begins to fester. We've got resentment. We've got hatred. And we've got bitterness. And the interesting thing is that from events that begin in the womb and some horrible events that take place in the family, things that we look at we probably don't feel good about in any way, this begins to play out so that it's even on the world scene today. You can read about some of these events, some of the terrible things taking place today and tomorrow and next week. Some of the things playing out in the Middle East today apparently come from these events that we're reading about in the book of Genesis. But I'm getting a little bit ahead of myself. Let's not get ahead of ourselves here. Let's turn now to Genesis 36, because there's a lot here. Genesis chapter 36, because as you may well know, Esau becomes the progenitor of a nation that receives a good bit of attention in the pages of the Bible, and a nation that no doubt is on the world stage today. Genesis 36, verse 1, it says, "Here is the genealogy of Esau, who is Edom." Esau is the progenitor of Edom, a nation that has several prophecies later on in the Bible. Verse 19, Genesis 36, verse 19, we're told the same thing again. "These were the sons of Esau, who is Edom, and these were their chiefs." And there's a lot of names in this chapter. It's a fairly elaborate chapter, by the way, that gives us the sons of chiefs of Edom, kings of Edom, some of the tribal chiefs there. Just notice in verse 17, by the way, Genesis 36, verse 17. "These were the sons of Reuel, Esau's son, chief Nahat, chief Zerah, chief Shammah." And I'm giving you the wrong verse. No, it's not verse 17 that I want. It's verse 16, sorry. Verse 16, "Chief Korah, chief Gatam, and chief Amalek." That's the one I want. And that maybe rings a bell. Amalek is there as one of the descendants of Esau. Amalek will be quite prominent elsewhere in the Bible. You remember the scene, we won't turn there, but in Exodus chapter 17, Moses is up at the top of the hill, and Joshua is fighting a battle in the valley below with an enemy that was particularly tough and ruthless and full of hatred. And that enemy down in the valley below is actually Amalek. You remember the scene with Moses' arms having to be propped up by Aaron and Hur. It's very interesting. Anyway, what we've got here is the beginnings of a nation. It's a nation that will be a thorn in the flesh of Israel and later of Judah all the way down through history and, I believe, right down to our day, the year 2015, the beginning of the 21st century. Early sign of the problem in Numbers chapter 20. Numbers chapter 20. These events take place as they're moving through the desert, through the wilderness. And Numbers chapter 20 is this rather well-known passage where Moses wants to find a shortcut, the easier route. They're coming northward as they're beginning to approach on the eastern side of the river, getting ready to invade the promised land, Numbers chapter 20. And beginning in verse 14, look at what takes place here and who's involved in this. Moses sent messengers from Kadesh Barnea, in that northeastern Sinai Peninsula, to the king of Edom. Thus says your brother Israel, you know all the hardship that has befallen us, how our fathers went down to Egypt and we dwelt in Egypt for a long time. And he goes through some of the story and rehearses. It's interesting. The Edomites had heard it. Verse 17, please let us pass through your country. We will not pass through fields or vineyards. We won't interfere with your agriculture, nor will we drink water from wells. We will go along the king's highway. We will not turn aside to the right hand or the left until we've passed through your territory. And then Edom said to him, no, you shall not pass through my land, lest I come out against you with a sword. Moses, not one to give up easily, presents the petition one more time. We'll go by the highway. We won't touch anything. We touch any of your water, we'll pay you for it. Edom's answer, no. Verse 20. You shall not pass through. So Edom came out against them with many men and with a strong hand, and Edom refused to give Israel passage through his territory. So Israel turned away from him, and this made necessary a pretty big detour on their way to the promised land and eventually invading at Jericho. But we're seeing the seeds here of something that is yet to play out in its fullness. A very deep enmity between the descendants of Esau and the descendants of Jacob. And at the beginning of the story was something that I think all of us would acknowledge was a wrong, an injustice. Resentment begins to build in the Edomites. The contention is there. The bitterness begins to build. And bit by bit, we come through this history. And it's interesting how much is actually said about Edom elsewhere in the Bible. In Minor Prophets this week, we went through the book of Obadiah. And I want to take you to this very short book of the Old Testament. It is, in fact, the shortest book in the Old Testament. Let's turn to the book of Obadiah. Unusual book because it's the only book not devoted to Israel or Judah. No, maybe not the only one because, of course, Jonah is not devoted to Israel or Judah, but it's the only writing prophet, I think, that's not devoted to Israel or Judah, at least in part. Book of Obadiah, let's turn there. Very unusual book, 21 verses long, directed to a Gentile nation. And it's got a lot of information that is very, very negative. Very negative information. People look at the book of Obadiah, and it seems to be a tough book. And I want to pick up really just about 5 verses in the middle of the book. But the introduction to Obadiah, 21 verses long, begins with the first 9 verses describing Edom. Edom is settled at this point. These are the descendants of Esau. They've settled in the Edomite territory. And I'm sorry I didn't bring a map with me, but you probably got one in your Bible. The Edomite territory was over on the eastern side of the Jordan River in the extreme southern sector. It was south and east of the Dead Sea. They settle in that area, and it seems that area was very craggy, very mountainous. And if you read all the way through the book of Obadiah, it indicates, actually indicts Edom for pride. They felt proud. They felt impregnable. They thought, no one's ever going to get us. We're fine. And from their perch, because there was a lot of mountainous area, it was very craggy, from that perch in that extreme southeastern area of the Middle East, they watch with a huge vindictiveness, rubbing their hands together as Israel is conquered and destroyed. Commentators disagree about the dating of the book of Obadiah. I'll give you my take on it. I think the event that's referred to here is actually the Babylonian captivity, seems to be the majority view among biblical commentators, in 586 BC. And if you familiarize yourself with that event, it was horrible. It was a huge, huge trauma for Jerusalem and for Judah. It was, in a sense, a psychological and spiritual watershed. Terrible things happened as the Babylonians came through. We sing, "By the waters of Babylon, there we wept, there we sat down, we hung our harps on the willow trees, and we yearned in nostalgia for Zion." And what happened in Jerusalem in 586 BC, as Jerusalem fell, was horrifying. The cruelty of the Babylonians was enormous. The book of Habakkuk records some of this. In the book of Habakkuk, we won't turn there, but Habakkuk turns to God and he says to God, "God, how can you use such a wicked nation against your own people? Your people, Judah, are not as wicked as the Babylonians." And he doesn't get a direct answer, by the way. So what the Babylonians did was horrible. What the Edomites did was arguably even worse, even more wicked, even more cruel, even more vindictive. So I'd like to just read verses 10 through 14 here, and then I'm going to read you a little bit from a commentary, actually the textbook that we use in the Minor Prophets class at Foundation Institute. Verses 10 through 14 present a catalog of some of the things that Edom did at this moment of crisis. There were other times in the history that are candidates for exactly what event it was, but I think it probably was the fall of Jerusalem in 586 BC. Whatever the case, Edom's behavior was reprehensible. Obadiah 10. "For violence against your brother Jacob, shame shall cover you, and you shall be cut off forever." And one of these commentaries makes the point that this is very deliberate. It doesn't say violence against Israel. It's violence against your brother. Verse 11, "In the day that you stood on the other side, in the day that strangers carried captive his forces, when foreigners entered his gates and cast lots for Jerusalem, even you were as one of them." So the Babylonians broke in screaming bloody murder, screaming for the blood of the Jews, and screaming to tear down all of the beauty of this city that had been the joy of all the land. And you've got the Edomites joining in with them, casting lots, maybe for parts of the city, some of the valuables still there after some of the sacking of the city. Verse 12, "But you should not have gazed on the day of your brother in the day of his captivity, nor should you have rejoiced over the children of Judah in the day of their destruction, nor should you have spoken proudly in the day of distress." So we've got violence, verse 11, standing aloof with a hostile attitude in verse 11, joy at Judah's calamity in verse 12. "You should not have done this," boasting at the time of Judah's distress. Verse 13, "You should not have entered the gate of my people in the day of their calamity. Indeed, you should not have gazed on their affliction in the day of their calamity, nor laid hands on their substance in the day of their calamity." Is a kind of a opportunist kind of looting that's going on in Jerusalem by the Edomites. I think this is interesting. It's not just history, because what we're reading about here is what can happen when people become resentful and bitter. Remember that at the heart of this, in the first layer of this, there was actually a terrible wrong that took place against the progenitor of Edom. Verse 14, it gets even worse. This is nasty. "Nor you should not have stood at the crossroads to cut off those among them who escaped." The scene here is of Jews desperate to get away from Jerusalem, because the Babylonians have come in, set fire to the city. They're killing the leaders of the nation. They're killing off people. And they're trying to escape, presumably trying to escape eastward. And the Edomites are there blocking their escape routes. That's how vindictive they became. nor should you have delivered up those among them who remained in the day of their distress. I'm going to quote to you a little bit from Charles Feinberg. Charles Feinberg, The Minor Prophets, it's a book that we utilize at Foundation Institute. It's quite good. It's pretty good. I don't recommend it without any qualification. There's no such thing as a Bible commentary of any kind that has no qualification on it, but it's quite good. Charles Feinberg was a Jewish man who was converted to some variety of Protestantism, but the commentary is pretty good. There are a few things there that we might not agree with. But anyway, this is what Feinberg says about this section, about the doom upon Edom. Charles Feinberg, The Minor Prophets, page 127. Such punishment calls for a presentation of the underlying causes of the wrath of God against Edom. Verses 10 through 14 give us the bill of particulars against a stubborn enemy of Israel. They portray conditions in Israel when Judah was invaded by Nebuchadnezzar. Edom resorted to violence against his brother Jacob. It was directed against Jacob, his twin brother. There were to be two phases to his punishment. Number one, a period in which Edomites were to be a captive people, shame covering them. Number two, a time in which they were to become extinct as a people. When the Chaldeans invaded Judah in later years, Edom, like the enemies of God's people, had assumed an attitude of hostility. Judah's goods were carried off. Her cities were entered by force. Lots were cast upon Jerusalem to sell her population into slavery. But Edom knew only hatred for his kin, entering into the calamity as one of the accomplices of the outrages. In addition, Edom feasted on his brother's disaster and rejoiced in the destruction of Judah when she was exiled as an alien from her homeland. Not only did he revel in the calamity of Judah, but he used arrogant language in exultation over his conquered enemy. This is bitterness, vindictiveness, and resentment at its very worst. They surely compounded their outrages against the distressed ones of Jacob. Note the extent of them. And then Feinberg's commentary goes through these verses. Violence in verse 10, hostile attitude, verse 11, joy at Israel's calamity in verse 12, boasting in Jacob's time of distress in verse 12, spoiling of God's people, verse 13, the prevention of the escape of the fugitives, verse 14, and the betrayal of them into the hand of their enemy, verse 14. And he goes on to ask, should not the Lord take account of this? His wrath is kindled with reason. Edom has merited his punishment. Gets pretty bad. How did it get to be so bad? Got really, really serious. And it's interesting because the book of Obadiah, you know, when you read the prophets, you find within the message of the prophets almost always there's some hope at the end. The book of Obadiah ends with almost no hope. It's one of the most severe books in the entire Bible. Revelation 13 and verse 10, we read a principle here. Revelation chapter 13 and verse 10. Revelation chapter 13 and verse 10. Revelation 13 verse 10. He who leads into captivity shall go into captivity. He who kills with the sword must be killed with the sword. Here is the patience and the faith of the saints, God's people, who are not involved in that kind of thing. Got to be very, very serious. What we've read so far is about a family feud, one that began in the womb, one that continues with two young boys who grow up to be men, one that gets worse with defrauding, with cheating, with lying, and it ends up with a deep resentment and deep bitterness. And Esau, Edom begins to become a byword, a watchword for bitterness and resentment. And I think there is a lesson there, obviously, for us. Because when people get into that kind of way of thinking, when they become resentful about things, this can be a very, very difficult thing to deal with. I think every minister in the church who's ever talked to anybody who was once part of the church and is left, and then they leave with a story about something that happened, or they claim happened, and some wrong that took place. It's very difficult to reach such people. Maybe some of us here have friends who recite stories about what they claim happened. Maybe they're true, partly true. You know, the point really is, when you look at some of these stories about wrongs that were done to people, what the interesting thing is that the original incident becomes less important than the response to it. That's something that I think would be good for us all to take with us. The original incident, maybe somebody was treated wrong. Maybe something did happen. Maybe something that ought not to have happened did, in fact, happen. But people who turn down that road and begin to go toward resentment and bitterness follow the direction of Edom. For us, sometimes, I just wanted to digress a little bit here before continuing with some of the information about Edom. But for us, sometimes in God's church, we can begin to go down that road when we compare ourselves with others. Sometimes we look at things that happen and we think somebody's been treated with favor and we haven't been treated with favor, or somebody's got something that we don't have, or somebody got an opportunity that we feel we ought to have had. And we begin to go down that road and the resentment begins to build. We've got to be very careful with that kind of thing. Let's keep our place. We're going to come to the book of Ezekiel briefly and finish with the book of Obadiah for the time being. But let's go to 2 Corinthians 10 and verse 12. 2 Corinthians 10 verse 12. For us, there's something that we need to avoid to make sure we never go down this road. 2 Corinthians 10 verse 12. The Apostle Paul makes an interesting comment here. There's enough on this subject for a sermon of him by itself. 2 Corinthians 10 verse 12. Paul says, for we dare not class ourselves or compare ourselves with those who commend themselves. But they, measuring themselves by themselves and comparing themselves among themselves, are not wise. Comparing ourselves among ourselves, and we're not wise. Funny thing, when you compare yourself with others, there's always somebody who's got more money, better car, more prestige, better looking, whatever, bigger house. And it's a funny thing, because when you get to know people, you discover that the person who has a bigger house than you maybe doesn't have the same health that you have. Or the person who's got more money in the bank than you maybe doesn't have the same satisfaction in his or her job. And yet we do this at times, and if we're not careful, and I've seen it happen at times among God's people, this comparing of oneself. Well, you got this, and I didn't get it. Got to be very careful with that. Among us in the church, it can come from comparing ourselves among ourselves. Sometimes that slide into bitterness and resentment even can come from self-pity, like King Saul with King David on his way up, and Saul, remember, indulging self-pity and going out to get David. This was the kind of spiral that overcame Esau, later Edom. Let's go to Ezekiel 35. Ezekiel chapter 35. It's amazing how much information there is about Edom in the Bible. There's a lot. Ezekiel chapter 35, and another one of these really, really tough prophecies. And there's several of them. I'm not going to go through all of them in the Bible study. Ezekiel 35, it's a fairly short verse. Mount Seir, the title in my Bible says, Judgment on Mount Seir. Mount Seir was a very prominent mountain in the territory of Edom. And again, it's one of these very tough condemning prophecies. Ezekiel 35 verse 1, moreover, the word of the Eternal came to me, Son of man, set your face against Mount Seir and prophesy against it, and say to it, thus says the Lord Eternal, behold, O Mount Seir, I'm against you. I'll stretch out my hand against you and make you most desolate. You know they're in big trouble whenever you read in the scriptures, I'm against you. I shall lay your cities waste and you shall be desolate. Then you shall know that I am the Eternal. Why? Verse 5, because you've had an ancient hatred and have shed the blood of the children of Israel by the power of the sword at the time of their calamity, when their iniquity came to an end. Looks a little bit like Obadiah, doesn't it? Very similar. The same bitter spirit, the same resentment. Verse 6. Therefore, as I live, says the Lord Eternal, I will prepare you for blood, and blood shall pursue you. Since you've not hated blood, therefore blood shall pursue you. Now, it's interesting, as we come into these prophecies against Edom in the prophets, in the Old Testament prophets, it doesn't mention, usually, it doesn't mention the original contention that gave rise to all of this. The bitterness of Edom overlaid the original injustice. There's a lesson there, I think. Verse 7, thus I will make Mount Seir most desolate and cut off from it the one who leaves and the one who returns, and I will fill its mountains with the slain. Verse 10, for dropping down to verse 10. Because you've said these two nations and these two countries, Israel and Judah, presumably, shall be mine. We will possess them. We're going to conquer them. This was Edom's resentful, vindictive reaction. Although the Eternal was there. Verse 11. Therefore, as I live, I will do according to your anger and according to the envy which you showed in your hatred against them, and I will make myself known among them when I judge you. Then you shall know that I am the Eternal. I have heard all your blasphemies which you've spoken against the mountains of Israel, saying they're desolate, they're given to us to consume. Thus with your mouth you've boasted against me and multiplied your words against me. I've heard them. Thus says the Lord Eternal, the whole earth will rejoice when I make you desolate. Whoa. Look how tough these words are. As you rejoiced because the inheritance of the house of Israel was desolate, so I will do to you. You shall be desolate, O Mount Seir, as well as all of Edom, all of it, with an exclamation point. Then they shall know that I am the Eternal. The lesson here, look at what damage hatred and bitterness can do. Look at how it can get out of hand. Lamentations 4, verse 21. Lamentations 4, verse 21. Lamentations chapter 4 and verse 21. Rejoice and be glad, O daughter of Edom, you who dwell in the land of Uz. The cup of God's judgment, shall also pass over to you, and you shall become drunk and make yourself naked. In the context of this book of Lamentations, God tells them, okay, you're sitting there watching Judah get it. It's going to come your way as well. There's perfect justice with God. Edom was enveloped in this resentment. I want to turn to Isaiah chapter 63, just a few verses here, before we move forward with a few lessons for us from all of this. Isaiah 63, verses 1 through 6. Isaiah 63, verses 1 through 6. This prophecy depicts God, or Jesus Christ, more accurately, coming forth from Edom, having brought justice, and having dealt with the problem. Some of the commentaries will say about Isaiah 63 that Edom here represents all of the enemies of God. Edom is symbolic in a general sense of all of the enemies of God. I don't think that's true. I think it is specifically to Edom. There may be a symbolic meaning here as well, but it refers specifically to Edom, who were these inveterate enemies of God's people. Isaiah 63, verse 1. Isaiah 63, verse 1. Who is this who comes from Edom with dyed garments from Bozrah? Interesting, it opens with a rhetorical question. This one is glorious in his apparel, traveling in the greatness of his strength. This is God, this is Christ at his return. I who speak in righteousness, mighty to save. Why is your apparel red and your garments like the one who treads the winepress? I've trodden the winepress alone. From the peoples no one was with me. I've trodden them in my anger and trampled them in my fury. Their blood is sprinkled upon my garments. I've stained all my robes. And look at this, for the day of vengeance is in my heart, and the year of my redeemed has come. Verse 6, I've trodden down the peoples in my anger, made them drunk in my fury, and brought down their strength to the earth. The image of Jesus Christ at his return, coming forth from Edom. Some people will ask, well, when we read all of these really tough prophecies, is this telling us that there's no future at all for Edom? Does that mean no Edomite will survive the millennium? Is it complete obliteration? And I'll tell you what I've concluded on this. I think when you read all the prophecies, there are some others, by the way, as well. Jeremiah has a prophecy against Edom as well. When you read all of these prophecies, what we're reading about is a nation that, because it went down the wrong road, has no future as a nation. It may well be that individual Edomites will survive all of this, but the nation, from everything I can see, during the millennium, the nation will no longer exist. But we've read about a dispute, a family feud, that came to be overlaid with bitterness, hatred, and enmity. A few lessons from all of this for us. It seems all Old Testament-y, but a few lessons for us. Let's go to Deuteronomy 23, verse 7. Deuteronomy 23, verse 7. There's an interesting comment here about Edom. Deuteronomy 23, verse 7. Deuteronomy 23 and verse 7. Moses wrote, "You shall not abhor an Edomite." for he is your brother. You shall not abhor an Egyptian, because you are an alien in his land. Don't abhor, don't hate an Edomite. He's your brother. Now, Edom didn't reciprocate. Edom was told by Obadiah, he's your brother. But that evil, wicked spirit took control there. But Israel was told, don't abhor an Edomite. Message, something we know from the New Testament, to love our enemies. Edom was an enemy nation to Israel. We're instructed to love our enemies. Matthew chapter 5, verses 43 through 45. Matthew 5, verses 43 through 45. Matthew chapter 5, verse 43. Jesus Christ says, you've heard that it was said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. And if you've got a Bible that looks like mine, the words love your neighbor in italics, because that's straight out of the Old Testament, and the words and hate your enemy are in regular type, because it is actually is not a quote from the Old Testament. That was apparently a common belief in the Jewish community of the first century. But I say to you, Jesus Christ, our Savior, says, love your enemies, bless those who curse you, do good to those who hate you, and pray for those who spitefully use you and persecute you. And it's tough, isn't it? Yeah, it is. It is for you, and it is for me, and it is for everybody. It goes against human nature, and yet, that's what he said, and that's what he commands us to do. When they mistreat you, pray for them. Don't hate them. Verse 45, that you may be sons of your Father in heaven, for he makes his sun rise on the evil and on the good, and sends rain on the just and on the unjust. And I think it's one of those things that we really can't do without the help of God. But we're told very clearly here not to allow hatred to develop in us. We're not to hate our enemies. We're to pray for them. Now, it's a challenge, probably one of the biggest challenges in our Christian lives. Luke chapter 17, Luke chapter 17, verses 3 and 4, related to this, Luke chapter 17, verses 3 and 4, the chapter here begins with a talk of the offenses. Luke 17, verse 3, take heed to yourselves. If your brother sins against you, rebuke him. And if he repents, forgive him. Forgive him. And if he sins against you seven times in a day, and seven times in a day he returns to you, saying, I repent, you shall forgive him. And yet sometimes, you know, people don't want him to forgive. We want justice, as we might gauge it, to come against him. I'm reminded of a story that I heard a number of years ago from a man that I got to know quite well, a gentleman, a member of the church, and he was actually a minister, but he described something that happened many years earlier that I don't recall the details, but he said he'd had a conflict with a particular individual. I think this is probably before he was ordained. They'd had some kind of a conflict, these two men. And then this time of the year came around, Passover came around, and they're all lining up for the Passover. And guess how it worked out? Yep, that's right. They're right next to each other in line. And yes, of course, they're going to have to wash one another's feet. And with Passover approaching, it's good for us to think about these things, you know. What about the ones in the church that maybe we have a little bit of a problem with? We're going to have to wash, maybe, their feet. Be willing to forgive, Jesus tells us. Let it go. Be willing to forgive. One other point here. We've read a little bit about vengeance. We've read a little bit about vengeance. And I'd like for you to go with me to... well, let's read the New Testament quote, first of all. Romans chapter 12, verse 19. Romans 12, verse 19. Romans chapter 12 and verse 19. The Apostle Paul writes here, beloved, he says, do not avenge yourselves, but rather give place to wrath. For it is written, vengeance is mine, I will repay, says the Lord. That's a quote. We won't turn back to Deuteronomy, but Deuteronomy 32 verse 35, that's where it's quoting from. Vengeance is mine, God says, I will repay. You know what? God's much better at it than you or me. He's much better at vengeance than you or I. It doesn't say vengeance is bad. It says vengeance is not for you, it's not for me, it's for God. Leave it in his hands. He's much better at it. You know why? Because it's not personal with him. It's not personal. God, when he administers vengeance, he does it in the right spirit. He does it in a spirit of justice. The problem for us with our human nature is sometimes if we get vindictive and vengeful, what we want is to get back at them. To get back at them. No, none of us have ever had that feeling, right? Yeah, I'm sure we all have. It's part of our human nature, and it's something that we struggle with. We want to get back at people. God says, vengeance is mine. So there are two elements in that. Number one, God does bring vengeance. Number two, we've got to have the faith to believe that that's true. He's good at it, we're not. And in the case of Edom, won't take the time to go through all of this, but in the case of Edom, I'll just give you the reference. You might want to take a look at it for the sake of time. Psalm 83 describes a confederation, and it talks about the fact that Edom had perhaps even been betrayed from inside of the confederation. Other nations historically turned against Edom. It took place historically. No doubt it will take place again, because I think that prophecy in Obadiah is dual. Vengeance is mine, says God. He's good at it. We're not so good at it. And finally, something that we've already referred to and alluded to here, we must avoid bitterness at all costs. When people turn bitter, when that dynamic, that spiral in which people begin to think that they've been mistreated, you know, and somebody's convinced they've been mistreated in whatever, and the spiral begins, and people spiral downward, and it's so hard to break the spiral. You ever talk to a person who's turned bitter? Sadly, it happens sometimes with people who are part of the church. In some cases, their complaints are right. In some cases, their complaints have some truth to them. But bitterness has to be avoided at all costs. Bitterness has been described as drinking poison and expecting someone else to keel over and die. Drinking poison and expecting someone else to keel over and die. That's what bitterness is like. You know, we're here in Texas, and we've got a whole industry, musical industry, that's based on being done wrong. I'm not a country and western fan, by the way. Maybe some of you are, so please don't get offended. But, you know, the country and western song, you lose everything. You lose your woman, you lose your truck, you lose your boots, you know. Play the country and western song backward. They say you play a country and western song backward and you get your boots back, you get your woman back, you get your truck back, you know. What country and western? Maybe not all of it. I'm sorry. Please don't. I know some of you are native-born Texans, but there's a lot of truth to that as well. Anyway, if you like country and western music, that's fine. You're entitled to have that. And you can stay in the church. That's okay. Hebrews chapter 12. I've talked to people who've gone down this path. Do not go down this path. Hebrews 12, verse 12. Hebrews chapter 12, beginning in verse 12. Therefore, Hebrews says, strengthen the hands which hang down and the feeble knees, and make straight paths for your feet, so that what is lame may not be dislocated, but rather be healed. When we begin to think in that spiral of this has happened and that's happened, it's unfair, and somebody treated me unfairly, and we begin to go down that road, it's like having the bones of your body out. You're lame, you're dislocated, you can't run properly. Verse 14, pursue peace with all people and holiness. Now, sometimes you can't, it's true. Sometimes you can't, but you do your best, the scriptures tell us to. Pursue peace with all people and holiness, without which no one will see the Lord. Looking carefully, lest anyone fall short of the grace of God, lest any root of bitterness springing up cause trouble, and by this many become defiled. And that is so true, brethren, because people in whom bitterness takes root, it's not just them. Often they influence people close to them. We must not go down that road. Don't ever let that happen. This is one of the big lessons of all of this material about Edom and Esau. If we get a basic, practical Christian living lesson out of it, don't go down that road. Yes, you have the thought come into your mind, I was done wrong. Yes, I've had that thought. Yes, we all have that thought. We have to be careful what we do with that thought. When we have the thought, you know, life hasn't treated me right. It's been unfair to me. Let's be careful where we go with that thought. Don't go down that road. Verse 16, lest there be any fornicator or profane person like Esau, who for one morsel of food sold his birthright. For you know that afterward, when he wanted to inherit the blessing, he was rejected, for he found no place for repentance, though he sought it diligently with tears. Interestingly, the book of Genesis takes us through those two accounts, the loss of the birthright, the loss of the blessing, and we evaluate it as we're reading Genesis, and we say, who's in the right, who's in the wrong? But when we get the echo effect of this later on, that's not the question anymore, because it never is. That's not the question later on. The question later on is, where are you going to go from that point forward? You know, we're in the United States of America, and in the teenage culture, and I hope some of our young people don't adopt this, but somehow people have gotten the idea that life is supposed to be inherently just. You ever heard teenagers complain? That's not fair, you know? I wonder whether kids in Iraq are complaining that's not fair right now. I don't think so. Some of the other parts of the world where some very, very unfair things take place. And I've come to believe, I think as most of us have, that life has unfairnesses. Things are thrown in our direction that are unfair. Everybody has something unfair that comes their direction. And the question, of course, is not, can somebody protect you when you go through that unfairness? I'm not saying that we should allow our teens to, you know, go through all kinds of terrible things. We do try to protect them against bad things. But as we go through life, something unfair happens to just about everybody. The question is not whether somehow you've got somebody who's going to smooth it all out for you and make sure nothing unfair ever happens. The question is whether you're tough enough to deal with the fact that some unfairness is going to come your way. That's the way it works. That's the way life is. Okay, so what about the future of Edom? I want to go very briefly back to the book of Obadiah and just pick up the last verse. The book of Obadiah, verse 21. It's an interesting study, all of this, and you might want to follow up by looking at the entire book. There are a number of other prophecies about Edom, but there's such a big lesson here. Obadiah, verse 21. This nation that went down the wrong road and then really ruined things for itself. The whole book is tough. The other prophecies against Edom are really, really tough. A warning there for us. But verse 21, Obadiah verse 21. Then saviors shall come to Mount Zion to judge the mountains of Esau, and the kingdom shall be the Lord's. It's interesting because it takes us right up to the time of the kingdom of God at the end of the book. And it's that word there, saviors coming to Mount Zion, in the Sansino commentary, there's a quote from one of the commentators who says that word saviors, it's actually moshiim in the Hebrew. It's the plural of the word Moses. Moses, it's a similar word to the word Moses. Moshiim. And the Sansino commentary has a comment that this is the Messiah and his officers. This is the Messiah and his officers. So is this us playing into the game? We're part of it. Messiah and his officers passing judgment. So for us, the important thing, of course, is not to get embroiled in the spiral of resentment, but to hold a good sense of judgment. A couple of scriptures to wrap it up. Daniel 7, verse 22. Daniel chapter 7 and verse 22. Daniel 7 and verse 22. Daniel 7, verse 22. Until the Ancient of Days came, and a judgment was made in favor of the saints of the Most High, and the time came for the saints to possess the kingdom. Kingdom mentioned at the end of the book of Obadiah. Is this going to be part of our work to judge Edom? Quite possibly. 1 Corinthians 6 and verse 2. 1 Corinthians chapter 6 and verse 2. 1 Corinthians chapter 6 and verse 2. The Apostle Paul tells us this, don't you know that the saints will judge the world? And if the world will be judged by you, are you unworthy to judge the smallest matters? We deal with the small matters and we build a sense of judgment. Our goal then is not to go down the spiral of, I've seen injustice, I've experienced injustice, getting bitter, getting upset, but to develop a sense of justice. Maybe we're going to judge Edom sometime in the future, sometime in the world tomorrow. Got to learn the lesson from some of this and get ready to administer justice at the time of the return of Christ.